May it please the Court, Gil Shelsby on behalf of the appellant, Brittany Spicer. Members of the Court, this case arises from a surgery which occurred which resulted in my client sustaining global brain damage. If I may just share some of the factual background, which I think is important. We are before the Court today on an interlocutory appeal from a granting of summary judgment as to one of the defendants in the underlying case, Dr. Osincoya. Dr. Osincoya was the pediatrician for my client. At age 15, he had been the pediatrician for a number of years. Dr. Osincoya diagnosed my client with a condition called GERD, which is gastroesophageal reflux disorder, and it is a condition that can be treated with medication. He referred Brittany Spicer to a ENT surgeon, one who removes tonsils, which is his primary practice. He took some information and history, made a decision to do surgery, and removed the tonsils of my client. As a consequence of that surgery, as in all cases, the patients are given pain medications. The pain medications that were prescribed to Brittany Spicer were taken. We contend that as a result of those pain medications, Brittany Spicer suffered a respiratory arrest, and no one disagrees with the fact that she suffered a respiratory arrest. She was not resuscitated until a point in time in which she had been deprived of oxygen for a substantial time period, which resulted in brain injury, which is not only affecting her cognitive function, but as well as her motor function.
Do I correctly understand that the nub or the thrust of your position is that the primary physician gave incorrect information to the physician, to the doctor to whom the patient was referred, which as a consequence misled that doctor to, you know, prescribe some form of treatment or medication that he would not otherwise have used?
No, Jacobs, my argument is that he had nothing to do with prescribing the medication. The argument is that the primary care physician did some things which were negligent, including a lack of information to the family as to what the diagnosis was, which was then inaccurately relayed to the surgeon who made the decision to do the surgery in this case. But the primary care physician did not have anything to do with the administration of the medication.
No. It's the communication of inaccurate information.
That's true.
What he did.
That is.
Or what you claim he did.
Well, it's a lack of communication between the primary care physician and the surgeon, because there was no communication, and we allege that was a negligence.
So it's not misdisclosure. It's non-disclosure of material information.
It's a non-disclosure to the surgeon who's going to do the surgery.
Okay.
It is also a failure to provide information to the family, who was then going to have a discussion with the surgeon, which would then be the basis for doing the surgery. If I can explain maybe a little more succinctly in terms of how a tonsillectomy is decided to be performed on a patient. Every expert who's testified in this case has said that the decision to do a tonsillectomy is based entirely on history. The ENT physician does not do, they will do an examination, but it's not based on examination. It is based solely on history.
As developed by whom?
Well, as developed by the surgeon, who then uses the resources that are available or should be available at the time of the consultation. In this circumstance, there was a discussion with the family about Brittany's medical condition and her medical history. And we contend that there are several breaches in the standard of care by the referring physician which resulted in a miscommunication. And the miscommunication is as simple as this. The surgery should only be done, and everyone agrees, in the circumstance where a child has had multiple episodes of strep throat in the past. It is undisputed in this case that Brittany Spicer never had strep throat in the past. Never. So surgery was done to remove her tonsils, which never should have been done.
Well, I'm having some difficulty. I clearly understand the concern you're expressing or the claim you're making against the surgeon, including arguably failure to obtain sufficient history in order to make a proper decision about whether to do the surgery. But what I'm having trouble with is why the pediatrician, under what theory did the pediatrician do something that was negligent when all the pediatrician did was refer his patient to a specialist?
If I may address that, Your Honor, because there is more than simply a simple referral in this case. There are a number of breaches in the standard of care that resulted in this inaccurate history that was obtained. The first is we contend that when Dr. Osincoya made the diagnosis that the patient had gastroesophageal reflux disorder, that's a condition that our expert says should have been treated with medications. So she never should have been sent to an ENT physician, and that was negligence not to treat that condition first and eliminate that, because if that had been done, there would have never been surgery. That's number one.
Okay, well, let's slow down here. Is an ENT specialist somebody who would be familiar with GERD?
Generally not.
No.
No.
So you're saying that because the patient had GERD, the pediatrician committed malpractice by not treating the GERD?
That's correct.
And how is that causally related to what happened?
If they had treated the GERD, corrected the problem, there would have been no need for surgery. But that's my first issue. The second issue...
And you have an expert whose opinion is that he committed malpractice by failing to treat GERD and instead referring her to a specialist.
That's correct. And that's only the first of them. The second is that...
Let me ask a question.
Sure.
If GERD is an alternative diagnosis that would preclude a tonsillectomy, why wouldn't an ENT specialists be aware of that?
Because what happened in this case was the family was not aware.
I mean, in terms of training.
Sure.
It's an alternative. Don't do a tonsillectomy when you've got this other condition presents itself. Why wouldn't an ENT specialist know that?
Well, an ENT physician would know that. They would never do surgery on a patient that had GERD. And the problem in this case is that the primary care physician doesn't tell the ENT, by the way, I think she's got GERD. And he doesn't make it clear to the family that, by the way, I think your daughter has GERD. And so GERD was never discussed with the surgeon.
So do all the experts agree that an elimination of GERD is not a function of the ENT specialist as a cause?
The treatment of GERD would have been done by the primary care physician.
I understand that, but in terms of making the decision on a tonsillectomy and whether to undertake it or not, that the ENT does not have, within his own standard of care, a responsibility to rule out GERD.
He could or would if he knew about it.
Okay, and does he make that determination on his own or in every case rely upon the referring physician?
He would rely on information that is given to him by the referring physician, which our expert says should have been provided. In other words, saying, I think this is GERD, or you get it from the family, who understands clearly that the primary care physician thinks this is GERD.
I want to make sure then the limited time we have that I understand each of your claims, that is what you're contending.
Okay.
The primary care physician negligently did or negligently failed to do. And so far we have two items. One, that GERS was the diagnosis and it should have been treated medically, not by a referral to a specialist.
That's correct.
And secondly, the GERS diagnosis should have been communicated to the family.
That's correct.
What else?
The third is that there was a failure in this case, and it's a critical piece of the claim that is made. There was an error in terms of the communication that, and the decision was made to do the surgery based on a history of.
What is the error?
The error was they did surgery based on a history of strep throat, which never existed.
But wait a second. Why is that the primary physician's problem? Isn't it the surgeon who based his decision on inaccurate information?
There's a reason why it goes back to the primary care.
And what is
that? A critical piece of evidence. After the ENT does his evaluation and he makes the recommendation and says, I'm going to do surgery because your patient has had four episodes of strep throat, he wrote a letter to Dr. Osinkoya, the primary care physician, and he said, because that's who it referred the patient to him, I am going to do surgery on your patient because she's had four episodes of strep. And my expert says that once he gets that letter and he realizes that there has been a miscommunication of her prior medical history, and he is the person of all the physicians who is most able to address that, his obligation under the standard of care is to let the surgeon know who's...
Well, you're saying the ENT specialist was told by somebody other than the primary physician that there was a history of strep throat, which was not true. A letter was sent to the primary care physician who should have responded by making clear that that was not factually true.
That's correct.
Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. And my expert says that if that had happened, the error as it happened, no matter how that was, whether it was a failure on the ENT's position or a failure to gain information, makes no difference. At that point in time, the opportunity to correct the error was in the hands of Dr. Osinkoya, and he did nothing about it.
Can we move for a moment to proximate cause?
Sure.
Why isn't what happened after the surgery a superseding cause that eliminates proximate cause as to the primary care doctor?
Your Honor, the reason why it is proximate cause is that under the proximate cause theory and law, it simply needs to be a cause of the injury. In this case, it is as simple as this. If the
I understand the progression that you're, you know, trying to make from if he had treated the GERD, then there would be no surgery, then there would be no complication from surgery, then there would be no damages. But doesn't the principle of superseding intervening cause come into play in this case? You're ignoring that principle of law?
No. I'm not ignoring it, and I think it is a reasonably foreseeable circumstance or event that occurred as a result of surgery in this case. In superseding intervening, it has to be some extraordinary event that occurs that would take it out of a proximate cause argument. And I do not believe that the facts in this case fall in that category for this reason. Clearly, if a patient is going to have surgery, and it would be well understood they're going to require medication afterwards. So to have a surgical procedure that then requires medication and an event occurs as a result of either during the surgery or the post-surgical care that results in this outcome, that is reasonably foreseeable. And I could give the court a perfect...
But I understood your position is that the surgeon prescribed an abnormal amount of medication.
That is one argument, but it is not the only argument I make. I mean, for example, my claim against the surgeon as well as Dr. Osinkoya is that the surgery never should have been done. If you argue that the surgery never should have been done, I don't have to prove that there was an excessive dose of medication given. If the surgery shouldn't have been done, any injury that flows from the result of the surgery is recoverable under the proximate cause theory. So that's not necessary to the argument I'm making as to the surgeon or Dr. Osinkoya. But I am frequently called upon, and I have many times folks will call me and ask me a question about whether they have a medical negligence claim. And after I listen to their story, oftentimes I'll find that they were involved in an automobile accident and they had to have treatment, and as a result of that treatment they have injury. And what I say to them is, well, you may have a malpractice claim, but let me tell you that you don't need a malpractice claim because the person who caused your initial injury, that caused you to need medical treatment is responsible for the subsequent injuries. And I could give the court a perfect example.
In your rebuttal time. If you want to use it, you're welcome to. But
if I may, just for 1 minute, and then I will sit down. If I leave the court today and I'm driving down Route 13 and I am not paying attention, I rear end someone who stopped at the light, and that individual has herniated discs, even pre-existing, but they're not symptomatic. But I cause them at that point in time to be symptomatic. They then need to have surgery. I'm certainly responsible because I was negligent for the fact that they required surgery. There's no question about that. If during the course of that surgery, the surgeon commits an act of negligence that results in them dying or becoming paralyzed, I'm the initial tortfeasor who put them in that circumstance, and I'm responsible. And that is proximate cause. Even if the surgeon doesn't commit an act of negligence, but he just has a bad surgery that results in injury, whether it's being paralyzed or they die, I put them in that surgical suite, and I'm responsible as the tortfeasor. So there is no difference. And in this case, in essence, Dr. Osin-Koya permitted the surgery to proceed, which never should have proceeded. And the consequence of proceeding the surgery were the injuries that occurred, regardless of whether there was negligence in the administration of the medication or not. This is a complication arising.
Can I interrupt you with one quick question?
Sure.
Can you show me where in the record an expert says that after receiving that letter, Dr. Osin-Koya had a duty to contact the ENT and advise him as to the correct facts? If you'd like, you can wait and give me that reference afterwards,
May I do that, Your Honor, if it will take me a couple of minutes. Thank you.
May it please the Court, John Ballagher for the Appellees, Dr. Osin-Koya, and Delaware Primary Care. Your Honors, the plaintiffs contended in the court below that Brittany Spicer suffered an anoxic brain injury due to an excessive dose of narcotic pain medication prescribed solely by Dr. Cooper, the defendant Dr. Cooper, for pain following a tonsillectomy performed solely by Dr. Cooper, and the surgery which was recommended solely by Dr. Cooper.
But apparently based upon inaccurate information, correct?
That's incorrect, Your Honor. The record is that there was no communication whatsoever between Dr. Osin-Koya and Dr. Cooper. Dr. Osin-Koya gave the family a referral note that said evaluation for tonsillitis, and that note wasn't even given to Dr. Cooper.
I understand that, but we have in the record a letter from Dr. Cooper to Dr. Osin-Koya saying, I'm going to do surgery because of a history of strep throat, and apparently that's not accurate.
Well, the history was given to Dr. Cooper by the plaintiff and her father at the evaluation by Dr. Cooper. That's when the history of strep throat was given.
But wait a second. Unless I've got the facts wrong, we have Dr. Osin-Koya, who has been her pediatrician for the last 15 years, who has medical records that indicate no past history of strep throat, correct?
Not 15 years, but several years and no history of strep throat. But, and this is a big but, Dr. Cooper testified that he does not rely on history given to him by a primary care physician. He doesn't want to know about it. He doesn't rely on it because, in his experience, it is oftentimes inaccurate because patients go to urgent care centers, emergency rooms, and elsewhere where they are diagnosed with strep throat.
So Dr. Cooper doesn't care what the pediatrician has to say. But in this case, the pediatrician has knowledge, at least based upon his involvement as the primary care doctor, he has knowledge that his records show no history of strep throat. He gets a letter saying, I'm going to do tonsillectomy because there's a history of strep throat. Opposing counsel says that he has an expert opinion that says that Under those circumstances, the primary care doctor has an obligation to provide what appears to be contradictory medical evidence to the ENT.
And that's the expert did testify to that opinion. But, Your Honor, I would suggest respectfully that before the expert's opinion is relevant, there must be a legal duty underlying that expert opinion. And if it's the case that the primary care physician's duty to the patient is extinguished when the subsequent surgeon makes the decision to operate, which is what the trial court decided, then after that, a letter comes to that physician, then there has to be a legal determination that that letter triggers a new duty that didn't otherwise exist in order for the primary physician to have a duty to respond, to make expert opinion on that relevant at all.
This well, these letters are written for some purpose. What was the purpose of the letter?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's normal practice among specialists as a matter of record keeping to send letters back. But it was an unsolicited letter, and from a practical perspective, if there's going to be a legal determination that this creates a duty for every primary care physician, for every letter he gets from every specialist, every hospital, to go back then to his patient's records, unless he has them memorized, and check to make sure that the history given by his patient to a subsequent physician is accurate, that's something that I would, again, respectfully suggest is impractical from the standpoint of a busy primary care physician.
Suppose, whether or not there was a duty, suppose the primary care physician did respond to the letter with information that was accurate, at least to the knowledge of the pediatrician. Would that make any difference in the outcome?
Well, that's a very good point, Justice Jacobson. I don't think there's any evidence in the case that it would have made any difference. Dr. Cooper testified again that he doesn't rely on histories given to him by primary care physicians because they are so often inaccurate because patients seek care elsewhere. And so it would require the jury to speculate about what the effect of that would be. There's absolutely no testimony whatsoever from Dr. Cooper that would have changed his plan, which he testified is always based on what I'm told by the patient and the patient's family.
Well, just following up on Justice Ridgely's question, you told us that the purpose of the letter from the ENT specialist to the primary care physician was because that's it's customary reporting. Not something that's designed to elicit a response. Is there any record citation to support that? Was there any testimony that explained the purpose of the letter?
There's no testimony I'm aware of in the record, Your Honor, about that would explain the purpose of the letter, other than the fact that the letter is simply a regurgitation of what Dr. Cooper wrote in his note when he saw the patient, an exact regurgitation, and it's a record-keeping function.
That's one inference, certainly.
Right.
Other inference is, why would the letter be written if it wasn't to invite some verification? That's the other inference. Doesn't really clear that up.
The record does not clear that up. However, I would suggest that if the referral physician was looking for verification of the information, they would ask for verification of the information. And here Dr. Cooper has said, I don't rely on histories that are given to me by primary care physicians because they're often inaccurate. I think in that testimony from Dr. Cooper makes the only reasonable inference that the letter was for record-keeping purposes only, so that there would be documentation in Dr. Osinkoya's file of what was going to happen to his patient.
What about this GERD issue that supposedly Dr. Osinkoya had the belief, based upon his knowledge of the patient, that she was suffering from GERD, not some tonsil inflammation, and that he failed to either, number one, treat that, or number two, alert the ENT to that as a possible diagnosis?
Factually, Your Honor, the testimony from Dr. Osinkoya was that GERD, which is acid reflux,
right,
can irritate the tonsils and,
right,
and cause what is in effect tonsillitis.
Right.
It may not be tonsillitis that needs to be operated on, but it may be tonsillitis. His diagnosis of the patient was tonsillitis and GERD. and he sent the patient to Dr. Cooper to evaluate that tonsillitis. The family was given a prescription for anti-GERD medication to treat the GERD. That's undisputed. And it's also undisputed that the patient took the medication, and yet her sore throats continued in between the time she last saw Dr. Osinkuya and when she saw Dr. Cooper. So the GERD was addressed by Dr. Osinkuya, and medication was prescribed. In terms of communication about that issue to Dr. Cooper, I would suggest that it's the same issue as the rest of it. Dr. Cooper didn't ask for any history from Dr. Osinkuya and testified that it would be his normal practice to take his own history and make a determination on his own about whether surgery was indicated, which one would presume would include discussion about causes of tonsillitis that might be non-operative causes.
Well, one of the multiple claims of negligence here or malpractice is that the GERS should have been treated medically and not by referral to a surgeon. And I gather your response is it was treated medically. It had nothing to do with the surgery. The
correct.
Surgery was for the tonsillitis.
Correct. That's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
But do we have any dispute of fact here on that? Because the suggestion is that Dr. Osinkaya thought it was GERD and didn't treat for GERD and instead referred to the ENT specialist.
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe, respectfully to my colleague, that there's any factual dispute about that at all, that there was treatment for GERD, a prescription for GERD that was given. There's documentation of that.
And that was before the referral?
But at the same time as the referral. Dr. Osinkuya said, I thought this might be GERD, so I prescribed medication for GERD, but it also might be tonsillitis unrelated to GERD, so I'm going to refer this patient to an ENT to evaluate that situation. So he did both at the same time.
Well, but that being the case, Dr. Osinkuya never followed up to determine whether it was GERD or not.
Well, if the patient would have returned to him and said, my GERD got better with the medication and I went to Dr. Cooper and he thought that meant I didn't need surgery, then that follow-up would have occurred at that time. But there was
No. What I'm getting at is that the suggestion seems to be that before you refer a patient to an ENT surgeon whose first and primary view of it is going to be, let's remove the tonsils, that you don't do that if the tonsil problem can be cured without surgery. And the primary care physician's job was to treat for GERD, and then only if that failed to resolve the problem, refer to a surgeon for tonsillitis.
And Your Honor, I think if this case went to trial, there'd be a dispute among the experts about that. But the threshold question is there any duty on the part of Dr. Osinkuya? Duty with respect to the surgery that occurred and preoperative and postoperative matters related to the surgery, once he makes a recommendation to a specialist who then decides to operate.
Let me put it another way. The question might be, is there a duty on the part of the primary care physician to attempt to treat whatever problems appear to be the actual diagnosis before handing the case over to someone who's a specialist in removing tonsils? Is there an obligation on the primary care physician's part to eliminate the less intrusive possible causes and cures before transferring the patient to someone else?
Well, in terms of a legal duty, I'm not aware of any case law that would address that as a legal duty. The case law that I'm aware of suggests that once there's a referral to a specialist and the specialist makes his own independent judgment, that the original duty of the physician is extinguished.
And it doesn't matter whether the referral was premature.
I would suggest that it does not, because if the referral is premature, the logic of the case law is then the referring physician, the physician to whom the case was referred, would send the case back and say, this is premature, I don't want to take charge of this. But once this physician relinquishes care of the patient to another physician, the duty is extinguished. The duty becomes then that of the physician who takes over
that
care.
Was that the case with regard to the treatment of GERD? In other words, is the treatment of GERD a specialty of the ENT?
Well, certainly GERD that is caused by, I'm sorry, let me start over. Tonsillitis related to GERD would be within the purview of an ENT. Sorting out the question of whether the tonsillitis is related to GERD or something else, and whether it requires surgery or not, is within the purview of an ENT. That was the testimony of Dr. Osincoya in terms of the thought process in making the referral, that this was a difficult problem to sort out. It involved the tonsils. Better to have an ENT make those determinations. I have a few more minutes, so I would like to just go back to
I'd like to ask you a question on proximate cause. Why isn't, if we reach the question of proximate cause, why isn't that a jury issue?
Well, the lower court's holding was on proximate cause, Your Honor, was based on the principle that there must be a reasonable starting point for the chain of causation. And that I would submit, is a legal determination for the court to make. That is this the reasonable starting point for the chain of causation? And that can be made by the court when there is no material facts in dispute, particularly when there are no material facts in dispute regarding the nature and relative effect of the interaction between the two alleged tortfeasors. And that's what distinguishes this case from Jones v. Crawford or from the Halchuk case that are cited by the plaintiffs. In those cases, there was significant dispute about how the interplay between the two alleged tortfeasors, which required a jury determination. Here, there are clean-cut lines where a referral is made to an ENT who, based on no information whatsoever from the underlying doctor, makes his own determination that surgery needs to be done. Then on top of that, makes his own independent determination about what medication to give to the patient after that surgery for pain. In those circumstances, that issue is ripe for legal determination by the court on the issues of remoteness and foreseeability. And while it's clear that this is a type of determination, that is proximate cause, that's supposed to be on the facts with mixed questions of logic, common sense, justice, policy, and precedent, in this kind of a situation where there is no real factual dispute, as I described, it weighs more heavily on justice, policy, and precedent, I would argue. And under those circumstances, that's within the purview of the court to make a threshold determination, as Judge Silverman did in the Vollendorf case. If I could just go back for a second to the legal argument on duty. Although there is no Delaware precedent directly on point, the trial court's ruling was undergirded by a line of cases from other jurisdictions that a referring physician's duty ends upon the referral to a specialist, including from Pennsylvania, the Belyabalt case, where the court specifically held that a referring physician's duty to a patient is extinguished once another physician exercises independent medical judgment as to the patient's medical care in performing a surgical procedure. And that's what this case is about, a surgical procedure. The injury, the risk of injury, and the injury itself all derive from the surgical procedure.
Well, let me give you a hypothetical. What if the first doctor knows that his patient is extremely sensitive to a certain kind of drug and fails to tell the doctor to whom he refers his patient about this sensitivity? Is it your position that there was no duty to do that because the second doctor just had to ask all the right questions, and even knowing that there's a particular concern with this patient, there was no obligation to inform the doctor?
In that case, Your Honor, the risk is present when the patient is in the first doctor's office. There's an allergy to a medication. That's a known risk that's present. That duty would continue, I would agree. That what distinguishes this case is when Brittany Spicer was in Dr. Rosenkoya's office, there was no risk to her from a surgery or from postoperative medication from a surgery. That didn't occur until another doctor made a decision, A, that she needed surgery, and B, that she needed narcotic pain medication in response to the surgery. And so in the hypothetical, there would be a continuing duty. In this case, there is no continuing duty for that reason. In addition, related to the letter issue, I would direct the court to the Hannes case, also from Pennsylvania, holding that a physician has no duty to follow the care of a patient after referring the patient to a specialist. And that relates directly to the letter here, where I would suggest that a new duty would have to be created by the letter, and the court would have to make a legal determination that the letter created a duty to act, and in a situation where there had not been a duty before because it had been terminated by the referral and the decision to operate made by the second physician.
You agree there's liability or can be liability for a negligent referral to someone who's incompetent?
I do, Your Honor, and that's a different case, but there are the exception to the rule that I've stated, that's one of the exceptions. If you make a referral, and again, that's the same principle. If you refer to somebody you know is incompetent, the risk is present at the time you make that referral, and that's why the duty continues and why it's a different case than what we have before us here.
Well, can that ever be revisited? What if circumstances develop later which would suggest, in hindsight, that the referral was to someone who's incompetent?
Well, then I think that if the doctor finds out about that, the court could decide that there might be a duty created at that point a duty to notify in those circumstances. Here, though, at the time of the referral. Well, even later, if the physician determines that, yes, I've now found out that this patient, that this physician I want to refer this patient to is incompetent, then there would be a duty to act under those circumstances based on knowledge of the incompetence. But there is no case law that would suggest that an unsolicited letter given to the doctor, that there's no evidence was requesting a response, would create such a duty.
Thank you. Your time is up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Justice Berger, you asked me to give you the cite on the issue. There are two separate areas where Dr. Banner discusses that. It is at A186 through 188,
mm-hmm.
and also A171 to 172.
And to highlight that, what exactly does he say?
In essence, what he says in both of those instances is that once the letter is received, and again, he's a medical expert, so he's opining on what the duty is.
Right.
Once it's received, he has to read it. He has to then, at that point in time, appreciate the fact that surgery is going to be performed for a condition that never existed, which is strep throat. And he then has the duty and obligation to call Dr. Cooper to tell him.
Well, wait a second. We don't know that that condition never existed. All we know is that Dr. Osenkaya had never treated her for strep throat. But that doesn't mean that she was on vacation somewhere and went to some other doctor or went to a clinic or went to a hospital and had strep throat.
Well, but what he would know, and this is why my expert opines it, is that if you're the treating doctor and you're familiar with this patient, you would know she's not had chronic problems with strep throat that she's been treated for over the years, and that's the medical duty that exists. So, I mean, again, that becomes that's a factual issue, which I think ultimately has to be decided by a jury. The experts in this case say, here's what the duty is. They will have an expert who says, well, that duty is different under the standard of care.
Well, isn't the question of duty, at least in some circumstances, a legal issue? And specifically the Hannah case, according to the other side, says there's no duty to follow the care once there's a referral. And aren't you arguing that there was a duty to basically examine this letter, follow the care, make sure that what's in this letter is accurate?
Well, that That is, we were saying that in that duty, but if the Marchese case, which is one that I've cited, says that there is a continuing duty, especially if you're the person who's got the big picture and you're overseeing it, and you get some information from the specialist, and you know, based on all the history you know, because you know this patient better than anybody else on this planet, your duty is to let that doctor know something's wrong here, because you're doing surgery on a patient who has a condition that as far as I know, never existed. And again, that becomes the factual issue, which I think ultimately has to be decided by a jury. All the issues in this case, I didn't get a chance to go through all my breaches in the standard of care. One of the breaches was because this is a young girl who had a horrible history, and the court's aware of it in the pleadings. She had psychiatric problems resulting in the horrible event that occurred to her. The communication should have been made directly with the referring doctor, so no miscommunication occurred.
Thank you. Your time is up. We appreciate the arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement and take a brief recess.